WGN. Let's start with Tom Gimbel on the Wintrust Business Lunch today, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network, who has a few things to say about mental health in the workplace. Tom, what is that? What's the obligation of, or the opportunity, say, for employers?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily an obligation. I think it's a benefit. And I think that, number one, employees have to want to take care of themselves. And number two, I think employers need to keep create a feeling of vulnerability that's okay in the office, authenticity. And all I can do is speak from personal experience. But as a CEO of a company, I started it 24 years ago. I'm a 50-year-old man today, and I've been to therapy a lot. I went through a divorce. I've been to therapy. When my kids had challenges, I had them go to therapy or encouraged them to go to therapy, which they did. And I believe that that's an important aspect of life. And I share my story with my company. I make sure that our human resources department has all of the therapists that are within our insurance network. So it's either a $20 copay or free for people to go. And I encourage people to go. And I don't know if there's much more I can do than that, but that's what is really important in my mind to grow as a human being and a professional.
How common is that? Do most businesses have that sort of benefit?
Yeah, I think more and more. So several years ago, insurance changed their reimbursement policies that mental health was included in plans. And so definitely for PPO, I believe for HMO as well, but if somebody's in network, it's very, very affordable to go to therapy and to talk. And quite frankly, there's actually places like the Jocelyn Clinic in Northfield, Illinois, that actually does it to help people who don't have benefits and don't have the resources financially to do it. So there's actually resources around in society that'll help people do it. But I do believe that for businesses, managers, and human resources and executive teams, they should share their own stories and encourage people to do it, because people who know how to deal with their issues and challenges in their personal life, they can handle their challenges at work even better.
You had a tweet about what the obligations are or responsibilities are for the mayor. You had three things. You said safety of residents, education of residents, attracting business to the city. What prompted that tweet, Tom?
Well, I've been on a little bit of a diatribe on the mayor for a few years now, and not due to political affiliations. And I've always said that political affiliations for mayors are useless unless we think Indiana is going to invade us. But conceptually speaking, I think that if we can do those three things, and violence is number one, our people aren't safe, whether it's drive-by shootings, whether it's carjackings or what have you, it's going on and on and on again. There was actually an editorial in the Wall Street Journal about it, that Chicago is taking a step backwards in the safety area. Number two is our school systems. And as we're looking at a mayoral election, is our kids being educated better than they were 3-4 years ago? I don't think that answers a yes. And then lastly is to attract businesses. And every other decision follows back to those three things, you're doing it right. And I think that if we can do that, if everything we say is, does this impact one of those three, that's how you run a city.
Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. The LaSalleNetwork.com is the website. What's your Twitter handle, Tom?
At Tom Gimbel.
At Tom Gimbel, and that's G-I-M-B-E-L. Okay.
Yeah,
Tom.
No anonymity here, John. I'll make my statements and I'll stand behind them. And I think Chicago's the greatest city in North America, but it's not the city that it was 4, 5, 6 years ago. And that stems from leadership.
Let's talk next week, Tom. Good to hear you today.
Stay healthy, John.
Philip Weiss joins us frequently on Tuesdays, president of Cyfarth at Work. Philip, you've got a few things to say about boomerang hires, and I'm not even sure what those are.
Yeah, well, you'll be hearing more about them, John, and good to be with you again. The term boomerang, which really kind of hit the business press starting a couple months ago with more frequency, refers to people who previously worked at a company and have been invited back, reapplied, and rehired because of the scant number of available candidates for many positions. And historically, rehiring someone who left even under potentially positive terms, was something that some bosses were reluctant to do because they're looking at this person and saying, are they really committed to my company? They've left once before. Can I count on them now? That objection has gone by the wayside, and in some cases, it's a great decision. In some cases, a boomerang returning can blow up in a company's face.
How is it that they're reconsidering that person anyway?
Well, part of it is the simple and clear need to fill in positions that are in desperate need of staffing. But the other interesting piece here is that a lot of employees who left, particularly in the last 12 to 18 months, kind of in search of greener pastures, perhaps thinking they could retire early and reconsider that decision, have come to reappreciate, look at their prior employer with a new sense that this place was actually far better than I thought, and in fact, superior to where I went to work instead. So bosses are looking at these people who left and saying, I need the person's skills. In some cases, they were a stellar employee who just made a decision to leave. Let me leverage that. And then the other piece, which is very logical, is the fact that if someone worked with you before, they may not need all that orientation training. Mm-hmm. They don't need that runway of time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of value to thinking about it, but sometimes mistakes happen because companies are too fast to welcome people back.
Well, what are the circumstances under which a boomerang left in the first place? Is it because they found a better job, or they thought they didn't need to work anymore, or were they asked to go?
Yeah, and those are the three categories you just articulated. And without looking at the raw data, anecdotally, it's about 30% in each category, maybe slightly less people that were asked to leave. But those are the three primary categories. And the ones that were terminated or shown the door, they're obviously the least likely to be welcomed back, because if they were performing in an unsatisfactory way or they caused damage to the company, that's a risk companies don't want to revisit. It's the people that left voluntarily that create, in fact, the biggest question marks. And some companies look at these people and say, you know what, they just didn't have all that much in the way of skills. They didn't have that much in the way of industry knowledge. Those kind of objections can really be a mistake, because if someone's been gone for a few months, if they were performing well enough when they were with you before, you want to take a look, because they may have now acquired those skills, expanded their knowledge, and have that new appreciation for your company. So small and even moderate skill gaps that you remember are far different than a huge gulf or a Grand Canyon of missing core characteristics to the company.
I'm glad I'm not the person evaluating another person. I think it would be very hard to know in an interview, or however lengthy the process is, what they're going to be like. Are you and your colleagues sometimes surprised? They seemed like a great candidate, and then they got on the job, and who knew? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a huge challenge in hiring in general, because there are some people whose greatest career skill is a great interview performance. That's their peak, John. It's not even day one.
Yeah.
It's 30 days before day one. And that applies to boomerangs as well. So it's so interesting that you raised that particular challenge. One of our companies, a shipping company, they really dodged a potential boomerang bullet, because they interviewed a guy who many people liked at the company when he was there 5 years before. He aced the interview with his charm, his memories of the company and the great people there. And then they took a moment and said, let's talk to this guy's former supervisors. They had to kind of track him down. And everyone's stories were eerily similar. The guy was loved by those around him, but somehow went AWOL in a crisis situation. When a key deadline came, he had the flat tire, the toaster that exploded, a whole litany of excuses. So you want to both keep your employment records so you can check on people's prior performance, and you want to talk to those that supervise them. So you're absolutely right. The interview specialist may not be the successful employee.
I suppose there's a group of people out there who really want the job or a job, but they don't want to do the job. It's it's a different set of circumstances, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, that's another really critical consideration when it comes to all hires, and particularly boomerangs, because they can fool you with what they talk, how they talk about the company, what the company does. But you want to think about issues and considerations such as, A, are they accountable? Were they accountable when they were first here 2-3 years ago? When something went wrong, did they step up and take responsibility and refocus on doing the right thing? So something like accountability, very important. Another one is, were they never satisfied with opportunities that were offered to them? Because that's something that typically doesn't change, and you often find that they may have had 7 jobs in the last 2 years while they were gone, and that's another red flag that they're not going to be happy no matter what is offered to them if they come back.
Philip Weiss is the president of Seyfarth at Work, Seyfarth, seyfarthatwork.com. Nice to talk to you. Always interesting stories, Philip. Thanks for helping us out today.
Great, and thanks for having me, John.
Jason Lansing is the founder of The Player's Trunk. You're going to see Jason again on Shark Tank on Friday, if I'm not mistaken. Jason, this is John. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
Did I get that right? Friday you're on Shark Tank?
Yeah, Friday, May 20th.
I thought you were already on Shark Tank once before. Is this your first visit to that show?
No, this is my first time. Well, I think your producer just reminded me we spoke July 21st, 2021, but it wasn't even in the works then.
So that was just your business idea with your buddy. What you guys do, the Player's Trunk, is sell gear worn by college athletes after they graduate. Is that right?
Yep, and since July, when the new legislation came out where student athletes can make money, we've done different verticals such as trading cards and merchandise. So we've grown since we've spoken last.
Name, image, and likeness. So now players are better able to cash in on their popularity, right?
Exactly. Well, the current student athletes now can put some money in their pocket by doing that.
Did you anticipate that when you opened up your business, or did you just think, well, after they graduate, there's no NCAA repercussions, so who cares? Let's let them and us make some money. But were you banking on that they would be able to do it while they were in school as well?
No, it wasn't even a thought in our mind. I think that it was very unpredictable. We had no idea when anything like this would happen, but it sort of fell into our lap and was a great transition point from how we started the business and to where we wanted it to be.
Forbes magazine said you guys are disruptors in the online sports memorabilia market. What does that mean?
That's nice. I think that for a few reasons, there haven't been a ton of companies out there, I don't think yet, that have truly wanted to help athletes. So, you know, see the athletes monetize where they see the lion's share of the profit. I think that's sort of a new business model that we brought to the table for athletes and can relate with them as we were co-founded by two student athletes themselves, but also as student managers, you know, we've been around the programs a long time and really can relate to these athletes. So I think that's probably what it means.
So who's an example then? Because we're talking about, who are we talking about? What are the athletes whose stuff you have or would be able to sell?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example since we last spoke. So, like I said, you know, I was a manager at Michigan. So my close friend Hunter Dickinson on the Michigan basketball team, he can now sell customized merchandise, autographed basketballs, autographed trading cards, and we've done all of the above with him and put some money in his pocket that way. But, you know, last time we spoke, that really wasn't an option.
So say a player is playing for the University of Illinois or Loyola or Northwestern, and the trainer or somebody like you comes up to him and says, here, sign this basketball. They do, and then you get some money and they get some money. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there's different ways to look at it. So how we would do it is we'd have them sign, you know, a bunch of items and put them online, and they'd see some money, and like you said, we'd see some money, and that's just the business model where instead of giving an athlete X dollars up front, you know, they're now seeing part of their profit. So they're inclined for their items to sell and can market it more and sort of are in charge of their own brand.
So they're pushing it out on their social media platforms, in other words.
Exactly.
And it's not necessarily like a card show where, you know, it's a signed flat surface or a signed jersey or whatever. It could be, though, game-worn shoes or socks, right?
Yeah, it could be game-worn items. There is a distinction while an athlete's still in school. They can't sell their game-worn stuff yet. So that sort of holds off until once they graduate. But like you were saying earlier, it can be jerseys from a bookstore. It can be cards. It can be basketballs, anything like that.
So would there be names I'd recognize? I mean, I'm trying to think of the, you know, college landscape here. I think of the pro names, of course, but we're talking about kids in college. How marketable are they? How much money is there out there for them?
Yeah, these kids have a large fan bases. It can be from their universities. It can be from their hometowns. They're all local heroes. So, of course, you'll see the top players generating the most buzz and the most revenue, but there really is opportunity for everyone out there. Like I said, it's very niche markets, and they do have close followings and followings on social media that they can really push their stuff on.
Where do you live now, Jason? Where do you operate your business out of?
I live in Chicago. My two partners are in New York. That's where most of the gear is and everything like that, but I've lived in Chicago my whole life, so I'm still here.
Jason Lansing's the co-founder of the Players Trunk, theplayerstrunk.com. So when I click on there, I'll see the stuff, the athletes, et cetera?
Yeah, it's sort of divided into stuff from current student athletes and then former student athletes, which is different offerings, and then trading cards and custom merchandise. So you'll see it all.
Who's the one you're really proud of? Who's the one that is generating a lot of buzz right now?
I don't know. I'd probably say Hunter Dickinson, like I said, from Michigan, just because, I mean, he's a close friend, and it's always really cool to work with your friends and be able to do this. We didn't really think that this was going to be an option. So I'd say personally for me that's one of them, just because, you know, there's it's more than business there.
Do you worry that this will somehow compromise the, I'm going to use the word ethic, but I don't mean that, but the amateur status of the integrity of college sports? I'm not phrasing my concern well enough because maybe I can't put my finger on it, but are you worried about what this does to the college athlete?
Well, I think it has a little bit already. You've seen crazy, I mean, I don't know how in-depth you've looked, but there are crazy storylines where people are holding out because they're not receiving enough money, you know?
The kid from Miami,
different.
Right?
Yeah, but I do think that when it's done the right way, which we're trying to do, you know, it's great. It's these athletes should be able to make money. It just sort of needs to be in a better, environment, I'd say. But, you know, how we're doing it, I think it's perfect, and I think these kids should 100% be able to make money.
So I recall it was something like the kid from Miami said, I'll come back to the school, but I need the boosters to come up with enough money for me to stay. Otherwise, I'll opt out. I'll either go into the portal or I'll go pro, which is sort of holding the school up if you're a good enough athlete, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's tough for the coaches. It's tough for the school. And I think that's an angle of name, image, and likeness that, you know, maybe I didn't think about before all of that happened. But
well,
there's definitely the good in it, which is where, you know, we're trying to help these athletes capitalize in.
Well, good luck to you. So you're on Shark Tank Friday. Mark Cuban's going to eat this up. He's going to give you $1 million. Don't give him the store. Don't give Mark Cuban the store, okay?
Okay, I'll take your advice.
Yeah, don't do that. Jason Lansing is the co-founder of theplayerstrunk.com. The Players Trunk is the business. He's on Shark Tank on Friday. Good luck to you, Jason. Let's maybe connect next week, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
Enterprising young man. 12:45, more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Illinois has suspended the online used vehicle retailer's license of Carvana. The license is needed to sell used cars and trucks. The Illinois Secretary of State says the company failed to properly transfer titles for vehicles it sold and misused issuing out-of-state temporary registration permits. The investigation of the company came after complaints to the Secretary of State. The office received at least 90 signed complaints. Carvana will have to resolve the issues before the license is reinstated. I'm Steve Grithanich, and that's your WinTrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. We're going to swerve into Tom Skilling's lane this afternoon and talk about the weather. There are a lot of farmers across parts of four states who are saying this about the derecho that hit Thursday evening.
I've never seen anything like that in my life.
And that life is 70 years so far for Mark Mergen, who farms near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He could see a storm brewing last Thursday afternoon, but he didn't think much of it. His son was tracking it, though.
And my son called me two or three times, and he says, "Dad, get in the cover."
And Mark says after about the fifth time his son called, he got in his Yukon and figured he could outrun the storm.
And that son of a gun, I got about a quarter of a mile, and it just overwhelmed me. The storm was on both sides of me, and all of a sudden, bang, it was pitch dark. And dirt.
Yeah, the Yukon was rocking.
Back and forth, and stuff hit the vehicle. I don't know what kind of stuff. Corn stalks, cans.
Were you scared?
Oh, definitely. I prayed hard.
And Mark says the color of the huge dirt cloud that swallowed him up was brown. Dirt in his area is black.
So I don't know where all the dirt come from.
The Mergens were among the luckier ones in a storm that killed two people. No injuries for them. Their houses are okay. But
we lost three grain bins. The dryer tipped over. I suppose if you figured it up, a couple hundred thousand.
Mark Mergen was talking to us from his tractor. He farms with his son.
He was so mad at me.
Their corn's in the ground, and now they're planting beans. Farmers in Illinois have about 55% of corn in the ground now, compared to a five-year average of 70%. From the farm to your belly, today's National Cherry Cobbler Day, and you can thank the farmers of Michigan, the number one cherry state. And since we are marking WGN's anniversary with memories, here's one. There were several years where our stars of yesteryear, like Orion and Bob Collins and Roger Treemstra, took part in the International Pit Spitting Contest at the tremendous fruit farm in Eau Claire, Michigan. Roger says he's pretty good. He said he could spit a pit 40 to 50 feet. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
On the WinTrust Business Lunch, let's catch people up on baby formula. Amy Guth, what's the latest on that?
Yeah, that's certainly a really big topic that a lot of people are talking about, and I know a lot of something that's on a lot of parents' minds, I'm sure. So Abbott Labs has reached a deal with the FDA to reopen the plant in Sturgis, Michigan. That is the plant where children who had taken in formula from that plant, four of them fell ill, two of which died, and really kind of started this whole ripple effect of this recall from these Abbott-based formulas. So there are conditions on this. One of them is that an independent sort of person must be in there to oversee all the testing and improved testing, air testing and equipment and certainly batch testing. And there's an immediate stop kind of so that if there is any of this bacteria tested in any of the finished formula, the plant will immediately shut back down. So timeline-wise, though, this is kind of the part to me that seems very interesting. And Bloomberg has done a lot of reporting on this, that once they get the green light and Abbott can the green light from the FDA and Abbott can reopen this lab, it'll be about 2 weeks from then when they can kind of start making this formula again. And they say it'll be about 6 to 8 weeks before it will hit shelves. So it's unclear whether or not that will make that big a difference, because even some competitors to the Abbott brands had cited some supply chain issues to make their product that are contributing to the shortage. Certainly this very large recall is not helping, because Abbott is responsible for several different brands of baby formula. But there is a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel here at this point, that this factory could get back online soon enough and be contributing to getting this formula back on shelves.
It's funny, this story would be more meaningful to some people who haven't had kids yet. Some children who need the formula now will age out of the need for formula by the time it's finally up and running again.
That's exactly right. And I think that's the frustration from a lot of parents. And I'm sure most of us have seen this on social media, connected to young parents who are really kind of at their wit's end. There's been, some different retailers that have said, you know, we're limiting, you can only buy two or three units of formula at a time. There's been some reports of panic buying that's also contributed to this. Gerber said that it had stepped up. That's a Nestle brand. They said they had kind of stepped up production. And of course, there are new guidelines that are being laid out right now from the FDA about what about importing formula made outside of the U.S. and those kind of quality standards, just to kind of alleviate some of the pressure, because it's a very timely issue. It's not a thing where, you know, a week or two we can solve this. Like, you know, if you need formula for your kid, you need it right now. So hopefully all of those things, you know, working together will help alleviate some of this for parents who are very worried, I'm sure.
United thinks it's going to be a good summer for travel, huh?
Yeah, so United is really being very optimistic. They've raised their outlook a bit. They say that they're seeing second quarter passenger revenue going up as much as 25% over the 2019 level. That's pretty important, because that's that pre-pandemic level. So that's sort of the benchmark that everybody's been comparing to. And so that's all according to a filing that United did yesterday. They told investors about a month ago they did think that they were going to return to profitability this quarter, in the second quarter, and they were citing, you know, record sales. They thought there would be this pent-up demand, and they also affirmed that there's a 10% operating margin here in the second quarter. So they're making, you know, big bets on that. This also comes at a moment in which they also said they noted that they're planning to pay, you know, up to $4.02 a gallon for jet fuel, even though just a couple of weeks ago they were paying about $3.43 a gallon for jet fuel. So even with that big price increase for fuel, they're still feeling very, very optimistic about summer travel. So we'll see how that shakes out. If that holds to their vision, that could be, you know, that could be a road to profitability and returning to some of that pandemic revenue that they lost for United.
Maybe I should buy jet fuel. $4 sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
I know. I was like, wow, jet fuel sounds better than automotive fuel.
No kidding. Chevy Blazers don't take it, though. iPhone, Apple Watch to get new accessibility feature later this year. What's that about?
Yeah, I think this is very interesting. And Apple made this announcement when they did, because Thursday is Global Accessibility Awareness Day. So they've announced some new features that are going to be coming to the iPhone, the iPad, and Apple Watch models later this year. And CNET did a great job of reporting this in a lot of detail. But some of these features are like a door detector. So for those who are blind or have low vision, they could use an iPhone or an iPad to locate a door. And this feature will also be able to describe the door. Is it open or closed? What kind of handle does it have? And information like if there's a room number or information on the door, like a name, which, you know, you can imagine even just going to a hotel room would be extremely helpful. Also, the Apple Watch will have a mirroring sort of component to it, so that, you know, if you've ever worked on, you know, tried to accomplish something on the Apple Watch screen, it's a tiny little screen. So this would allow mirroring to a smartphone or to an iPad. So it's not such a tiny little screen there, so you have larger, you know, a little bit more room if you need some assistive features with that. I think they're really interesting accessibility features. Another one of them is captions for iPhone, iPad to help with FaceTime and video conferencing, streaming media, things like that. So it will launch it'll start in beta in English later this year, and then it will also update to have over 20 languages shortly after that. You know, so that way if you're FaceTiming with somebody and you need the captions, that will be an option for you.
What an idea. Good one. Yeah. Amy Guth reporting on the WinTrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.